pensando alguma coisa e fedeu, acho que...
Tony's a little embarrassed today because he really has very little new to tell you. And, you know, he likes to tell jokes and be humorous at the beginning, but he doesn't have much to say. But this class is about redundancy since it's the last class, so just, you know, be patient with him.
I do have a surprise, though.
Oh, good. How many performers do you have? Eight?
Huh?
How many performers?
Eight performers, and it's exactly 3 minutes.
How's it going?
It's going
pretty
well.
Good.
Papers, due Friday, January 10th. The performance date is the 11th. Please, desperately, we need your forms today. We're still missing about 10 of them. And we really, even if you don't know who's playing your piece, get us in the form so we can program it. And then you can always call us, call your TF, and just let them know who's playing. Review sections are the week of January 13th. And they're Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at 7 to 9 p.m. on room 1. Jeff's teaching on Monday, Andy on Thursday. The final exam is Tuesday, the 21st. At 9 a.m. Science Center C. And a couple of students asked me yesterday to, on Monday to check whether the lecture tapes were in fact at Hillis. They are, we called and checked, so they must have been misfiled or something like that. But be very determined when you go up there because they're definitely there.
But we didn't start recording until what, about the...
About the fourth or, no, maybe about the seventh lecture.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah, so about the first... Five or six won't be there.
Their history.
But around from the middle of October on, you should be able to get the complete set. Okay, thanks.
That wasn't so bad. That was pretty good. A couple of quick announcements. I know some of you were interested in the Harry Parch video, and actually it became publicly possible to buy it as of about 6 months ago, and if any of you want to get it, you can come up after class and I'll give you the address. It's a little bit expensive. It's like $35 or something like that. But it's well worth it, and it is a very limited edition that they're putting out of it, so if you are interested in getting it, I'd suggest you get it soon. Another few quick comments. The sort of support system you get in a course like this at Harvard is absolutely wonderful. It's sort of not obvious to you what sort of work goes into things like the source book and all the tapes and those things, but the people who've been associated with this whole thing have just been marvelous. And one person I wanted to thank very strongly for her support is our sound person, Cheryl. Are you up there, Cheryl? Come out, please. You don't even notice her because she does such a good job. Any request we've ever had has just been done so beautifully, and I just want to thank you, Cheryl. And the other gratitude I'd like to express, other than to you all for your interest in this and your attentiveness all term, is our teaching fellows. I can't imagine a better group of people who cared more about you all term, who put more energy into what they prepared for you and how much they really genuinely cared about all of you, and I would really like to thank the four of them for. The piece I played for you may have recognized. I played it 26 classes ago, the very, very first class. It was a piece by John Zorn, who we talked about last time. And John Zorn, as I said, is a composer whose music really developed in the 70s and illustrates a lot of what I'm going to talk about today. Quick quote of John Zorn, I think it's interesting. My heroes are Harry Parch, Steve Reich, Ives, Stravinsky, and Varese. All these people I see as a line. I see myself at the end of that line. The biggest influences I had were Stravinsky, who worked in block form, Ives, who was always interested in weird juxtapositions and discontinuity in a certain way, and what came off of the tube, which I was brought up on. As a baby, I was watching all the time. To keep me quiet, my mother used to put me in a basket in front of the tube. My music draws on rock elements, blues elements, classical elements, ethnic folk music, and the music put together, as you say, in a very filmic way, a montage. It's made of separate moments that I compose completely regardless of the next. And then I pull them, cull them together, and put them together in a style that causes questions to be asked rather than answered. Well, one thing was clear about the mid-70s. For one thing, obviously the revolution was over, and the kind of issues of moral imperatives were over. And a composer growing up in the mid-70s was in a position which I sort of equate to having a grand buffet of possibilities. I mean, this is a very large table of possibilities the composer had in the mid-70s. From America alone, he had this whole tradition from Ives. He had the whole notions of Cage. He had the whole serial tradition of Babbitt. He had the more narrative tradition of Carter. Plus all the minimal music, all of the new romanticism, all of the different movements like performance art that were going on. These were all choices on the table. Now, the difference of this table versus the old dinner, let's say, the composer had in the 60s was that because there's no moral imperative, it's not a single course dinner. You could pick and choose and you could make your own, like John Zorn did in the piece you were just listening to. Other influences from America that were extremely influential in 70s were jazz, for example. Many composers listened to jazz a great deal, and it got into their music and played jazz. Also, by the mid-70s, almost every composer, as Todd Machover illustrated very well, had listened to a lot of rock and roll, if not played rock and roll. So one portion of the table had this tremendous quantity of possibilities that were developed from America. Another portion of the table had all the new technology. By the mid-70s, synthesizers were fairly inexpensive, they were easy to get, and they were pretty easy to use. Todd talked about digital technology or computers, and at that stage it wasn't developed, but what we call analog technology or a possibility of producing sounds with synthesizers in those days, there were the Moog, the Buchla, the Arp, were already getting into popular music and classical music, and it was possible for a composer with not that much money to own their own electronic sound system. Another portion of the table had all the influences of Europe. Not only all these names, plus a lot more, but also because Europe had always supported its arts more, many, many recordings of contemporary European music were available. People like Pierre Boulez, who Todd mentioned, and Karlheinz Stockhausen, and Xenakis, and all the composers that were developing interesting new ways of thinking about music were readily accessible to the young composer. Another thing that was accessible to the young composer in those days was music that was non-Western, and this was having a tremendous influence in this country. Balinese music, the sound of Balinese music, it infiltrated lots of music, African music, Chinese music, Japanese music, Indian music especially after the Beatles introduced it in Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So the young composer growing up in the 70s had this banquet of possibilities in front of him with really no direction of how to choose except their own personal relevant history. And I think one reason that I asked Todd Machover to come here, besides the fact that he's a very interesting fellow and knows about the most modern technology and all of that, is that I think he really illustrates better than almost anyone I know this grand buffet. Because here's Todd, who grows up with a mother who's teaching him the principles of John Cage when he's not even old enough barely to walk, you know, having him make instruments and figure out how to notate it. His father is into the most extreme technology from the time he's a little kid, and it's creative technology. It's not given technology. He's into all sorts of new graphic design programs. At the same time, Todd goes and he studies with Elliot Carter. He takes classes with Milton Babbitt. He plays in a rock and roll band, and he goes off to Europe and works with Pierre Boulez for 5 years. I mean, that's really a very interesting blend of cultural influences. Certain ones that I mentioned before certainly don't enter into Todd. He's not very influenced by Indian music, but there are other composers that were. So this notion of relevant history comes back. And it comes back in a strange way in the 70s because American soil was so fertile then, culturally. So many possibilities were open, but there was no basic direction anymore. That's what I was talking about last class, the fact that the primary movements were defocused, and so all of these were wonderful possibilities that the young composer could choose from. Today's a redundant class, since it's the last class, so I'm not going to try to be very original, and I want to go back through some things and just talk about them again. And I wanted to go back and sort of talk about why the soil was so rich and where that led in the 70s. And obviously, I think very, very clearly, the father of this whole opening of possibilities was Charles Ives, as you well know. Charles Ives chose not to be a professional composer because the only way in his period where you could be a professional composer is if you took European premises, if you wrote music like the European masters, if you wrote music in the proper style. But if you wrote music that used popular influences, that used folk elements, that used hymns, that juxtaposed them in all sorts of different ways, it was considered unprofessional. I think a very good illustration of the fact that I don't think he could have called himself a professional composer taking that moral stance. There was another composer you listened to by the name of Carl Ruggles. I think he was on your sixth tape, if I'm not mistaken. And it's a piece called Men and Mountains, if you remember that. It was with some Ives pieces. I think an illustration of the dilemma that Carl Ruggles was in, as well as Ives, was shown the story that I'll tell you about when a friend of mine, Jim Tenney, went to visit him at a rest home in the later period of his life. Jim Tenney, if you remember I played for you this very strange piece that used vowel formats and translated into piccolos and all of that. Well, that's Jim Tenney. And Jim Tenney's always been very, very interested in American music. Well, Jim Tenney went to visit him in the rest home, and before he went in, the nurse made a strong point of coming up to him and saying, "Be very patient with this fellow. He's not in his right mind. He keeps insisting he's a great American composer." So when he says this, just nod your head and agree, because if you say anything, you know, like, come on, then he'll just get very upset. This was the level I think that Ives would have been taken on, too, if he were to call himself a professional composer in those days, because the stance he took as an individual was a stance that was not acceptable in those days at all from a moral point of view, because it wasn't in the definition of what music should be. Let's quote Morton Feldman a lot today. I really like Morty Feldman, so I brought his essays. Let me find that. Where did my marker go? There it is. the interesting thing about Ives divorcing himself from the definition of being a professional composer was it allowed himself to be free in his music. And this quote of Feldman you both read, and I think I've read to you, or you've certainly seen it in sections. For art to succeed, its creator must fail. How many times have I felt, when listening to a work of Cage, a sense of regret or loss for its creator? And when we meet face to face at these encounters, I would really like to say to him, let me extend my condolences to you personally, but tell Atlas Eclipticalis it was the most thrilling experience of my life. It's interesting, Ives is still called an amateur by many critics, and he's still getting a tremendous amount of kind of negative comments that he's really basically an amateur and was never a professional composer. There was a colloquium here the other day, which I can only paraphrase, I wasn't at it, but I'll bring up one of the points that was made at it, and I think it's a very interesting point. One of the points was that Ives failed in a certain way because he didn't live up to his own ideal standards. Because in his music he didn't do exactly what he set out to do in a certain kind of ideal philosophic way, somehow the music was less than it should be. Well, this is an interesting point, and it's a point that I think applies as much to you as it does to a composer, and that's this duality between what you are and what you feel you should be. Let's say you have certain prejudices. Well, on one level you have to accept that's what you are, but on another level you can aim to go beyond where you are and try to be that person. And I think every composer we talked about this term, we've talked about it in an ideal way, but on another level, they are real people that aren't quite those people. I think a good illustration of that is John Cage on another level. I remember when we did his 75th birthday week, we did a whole week of concerts. It was absolutely shocking to me that every morning, the first thing Cage wanted to do was go out and get the reviews of the previous night's concert and wildly read them. And almost all the reviews were negative, and he was very upset by that. He really took it personally. Now, everything you've read of John Cage sort of leads you to believe that, oh, why would he ever read reviews, and what would he care what a critic said of all people? I mean, why in the world would he care? But on another level, I remember when I was in college, your age, being often very upset with John Cage because he would say something and do something slightly different from that. But that's the duality I'm talking about. And that's why I read you the Feldman quote, because for the artist to succeed in a certain way, for the work of art to succeed, the artist must fail. Ultimately, the artist can do nothing more than succumb to their own personality and do the very best they can in a work, which does not mean that they don't have ideals, that they should be something better than that, but in a certain level, a work of art is about that person at that time and place in history, and you really can't criticize someone for not living up to their ideals. I think you can only criticize someone for not having ideals to live up to. And when you experience a kind of frustration with, let's say, an Ives or a Cage or a Babbitt that has very clear ideals and doesn't quite do that in a certain way, it's only because they're human. And in a certain level, you have to forgive that. Now, with Ives, I think of Ives in a certain way as kind of a combination of Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Edison in contemporary American music. He liberated so many of the ideas and preconceptions we had about music and completely threw them out the window. For one thing, he completely liberated the notion of form being this kind of structured, almost apartment-like idea where you move from room to room to room neatly. And his music becomes much more about a kind of process of things working themselves out. And it also becomes about a process of a lot of things going on at the same time. It's a very American music, isn't it? Walk down the streets of New York City, and it's not that different from the music of Charles Ives. There's just millions of things going on at the same time, and they seem to have nothing to do with each other. And their direction is simply because someone's walking down the block from one end to another. Another thing he liberated in music that was extremely important was the whole notion of material. Before that, these composers said that things in music had to be very sacred. The note was a sacred thing. You certainly couldn't use... Pardon me, you certainly couldn't use like folk music and hymns and the kitchen sink and everything that Ives put in his music in a serious way. And I said that this is not true. You can put anything in a piece because your relevant history determines what a piece is about, not what these people from Germany 200 years ago said a piece is about. Another thing he liberated from music was tonality. He said that a piece of music should be about what it's about, and if it has to throw away tonality, let it throw away tonality. That's what the piece has to do, then do it. Another thing he threw out was the whole conception of tuning, like his piece that you heard a long time ago of two pianos tuned a quarter tone apart. Again, tuning's relative. It's a matter of what the piece needs. It's not a matter of an absolute anymore. So Ives eliminated, in a certain way, all the absolutes from music. And a piece I talked about a long time ago also, the Universe Symphony, which was the last piece he worked on. He never intended to write it. It was a conceptual piece. It was a piece about this ideal piece of music that would happen in the countryside with millions of people playing and people singing and all sorts of composers contributing to it. So a piece of music didn't even anymore have to be something that was about even sound, just simply an idea. Well, this notion of relevant history, I think, has become strongly stated in almost all the composers we've looked at, and I've taken really extreme composers this term, and the term in a certain way has had an extreme prejudice like any course or any history or any point of view will have. But the reason I picked them was that they were extreme, and I wanted to get you thinking about certain kinds of ideas. And the ideas I wanted to get you thinking about I thought would be best understood if I took very, very, very strong examples of them. That's why we didn't do some of the more mainstream American composers who you'd probably be more familiar with. And that's why we took some of the extremely eccentric ones, like a Harry Partch or a Nan Caro or a Dane Rudyard, that expressed very clearly certain notions about aesthetics. But I think the two clearest, and the ones I spent the most time on, were, of course, were Cage and Babbitt, because I think that they represent a yin-yang polarity that's very, very extreme and very, very clear what they both stand for. So I asked the I Ching about how to think about Cage and Babbitt for this class, and I got number 26, which is called Taming Power of the Great, which I thought was rather nice. Not only because I thought Taming Power of the Great for Cage and Babbitt is a nice metaphor, but this is the 26th class. It's nice I got the 26th hexagram for the 26th class. And it said, the thing about the Taming Power of the Great, you should look at it from three points of view. It involves three things. It involves holding together, holding back, and nourishing. Now, when we talk about relevant history in Babbitt and Cage, neither of them reject history. Babbitt embraces it, but so does Cage. Cage doesn't embrace the same history, but Cage has many references all the time in his writings and his thinkings to different histories. One of the histories that he's very close to are people associated with the Dada movement, especially the composer Eric Satie and the artist Marcel Duchamp. He talks about them constantly. He's always quoting Meister Eckhart, the mystic philosopher from the medieval period. He's always quoting Ulysses or James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake. And he's also quoting many ideas from Zen Buddhism. So it's not that Cage is divorcing himself from history. It's his own relevant history is what he's embracing. So let's take it from the point of view of holding together. I think the interesting thing about Cage is he takes music apart to hold society together. It's a kind of ironic idea. But Cage is a very social composer, as you know. And his ideas are very much based on the direction he thinks society needs to go in. So he feels that if American society, which is fundamentally different from the European society of 100 years ago, is going to be held together, then it needs its own music. It needs a music that everyone can listen to, not just the elite. Remember I talked about art and aristocracy as being related. Well, Cage was willing, in a certain kind of way, to eliminate the very notion of art so that a new art could be found that would really apply to all the people, not just some of the people. And this has caused a good deal of offense with many people and a lot of confusion and even a lot of bitterness. There's been no question of his importance in this century. He's probably in the last half of the century the most important artist in terms of influencing all the art forms of anyone I can think of. He's had a tremendous influence on dance, on theater, on the art world, and certainly on music. And he's probably the first composer I can think of, American composer, that had a tremendous influence on both European and Japanese music as early as the 50s. But again, as I say, it caused a lot of bitterness. Schoenberg said he was a genius, but he said he was an inventor of genius, not a composer. He called him an inventor. And Pierre Boulez, who's the famous French composer we keep coming back to, I don't know why, but we have, he said of Cage, they were very close at one stage, and he influenced Boulez a lot and actually introduced Boulez to this country. Pierre Boulez says, John Cage is a great thinker. I just don't like what he thinks. And I think a lot of people have felt the same thing about that. But the idea of holding together society by creating a new art form is a very, very strong moral stance. And as I say, ironically enough, it involved taking music apart in order to hold a new society together. Now let's go to the point of view of holding back. And this is something that is very clear in Cage, and that's the idea that trying to directly express something from one person to another, he felt, was not only impossible, but a kind of immoral stance for a composer to take. The idea that someone was telling you how to hear a piece, and if you didn't hear it that way, you were somehow fundamentally wrong, was a stance that he wouldn't take in his music. And one thing you can feel from having listened to all the music you've listened to this term very strongly about is that whenever you listen to a piece of John Cage, you're not hearing it incorrectly, because he's like taking you on a trip through nature. However you want to perceive his music, you're free to perceive it. There's nothing to get, and there's nothing not to get. So he's given you a music which you can make your own any way you want to make. The third notion of nourishing, I think, is a very, very, very strong one in Cage. And the nourishment in Cage is a kind of gift that, by giving up art, as it's been known, maybe we can really live in the present for a change. Maybe we can really be alive to listening to the sounds around us and to not worrying about the historical value. The past is a very safe place to think about, isn't it? You can make it anything you want it to be. A friend of mine just wrote a piece about the past called Pathways to Security. What could be more secure than the past? You can believe anything you want to believe about the past. You don't have to think about certain issues. You can think about whatever you want. You can make it as comfortable as you want. But living in the present's a little scary, because you don't know what you're going to get. It's a little scary because you can be hurt. You're vulnerable. You don't have the protection of history separating you from a moment in time. But the notion of being truly alive in the present, which is Cage's notion, is an incredible nourishment. It's saying, hey, you're incredible. You're as great an artist as I am. Listen to the world around you. Again, to be very redundant, I'll read you something which you've read and I've read in class. But remember, repetition ensures closure, and this is the last class. There's also a great line from the I Ching that I've always liked a lot in teaching. It says, repetition allows the student to make the material his own. So I will repeat one last time what Cage says is the purpose of music. And what is the purpose of writing music? One is, of course, not dealing with purposes, but dealing with sounds. Or the answer must take the form of a paradox, a purposeful purposelessness, or a purposeless play. This play, however, is an affirmation of life, not an attempt to bring order out of chaos, nor to suggest improvements in creation, but simply a way of waking up to the very life we're living, which is so excellent. Once one gets one's mind and one's desires out of the way and let it act of its own accord. Our musical parents, I can't imagine more nourishing and more wonderful ones, and Babbitt is the same sort of person. But Babbitt, if I think of Cage in a way like an inventor who recreates new things, I think of Babbitt more as like a scientist. And where in science, very often, we have revolutionary new ideas, they're always based on tradition. Like one of the new theories these days, which I talked about a little bit last time, the superstring theory, always has to be correct with respect to relativity and quantum mechanics and the laws of Newtonian physics, etc. And Babbitt believes the same thing. He believes very much that although his music perhaps comes out very, very radically new, that he believes it comes out of a tradition and that it comes out of a real history. I think one of the most ironic parts about Babbitt and Cage, in a sense, is the Cage studied with Schoenberg, and Babbitt never did. Babbitt, I think of as an extremely American composer, like Cage. He never wanted to study in Europe. His ideas are still very misunderstood in Europe, and he's one of the main composers, probably, in this country that has hardly ever played outside of this country, although there is becoming a interest in just very recently. But let's go back to Babbitt from the point of view of these three points. First of all, holding together. Well, Babbitt, by believing the fact that tradition is relevant, and like science, it can change drastically from generation to generation, still it's based on a continuum. And by holding tradition together, you're holding society together. Cage is explicitly a social composer. Babbitt is not an explicitly social composer, but implicitly it's a very strong social stance to say, I'm going to base my music on what I believe to be the continuum of the greatest thinking of the Western mind throughout its history, and I'm going to try to bring it into the present, and I'm going to try to make it relevant. And I'm going to try to make it relevant how? By creating the metaphor, which we've used a lot, a mirror on which to dwell, a completely self-referential system, a system where everything in it is a mirror of everything else in it, where every part of the piece is a particle of the whole as well as a reflection of the whole. And in this holding together in Babbitt, it's by taking this abstraction, creating a new model of how to listen to a piece so that the piece itself is completely contained without needing a lot of, ironically, historical context, because the piece is completely self-contained. But let's take the point of view now of holding back. And this is where Cage and Babbitt, I think, merge. And this is the one place where the next generation really rejects both of them, which we'll talk about in just a second. And one of the most interesting aspects of both Cage and Babbitt, and that's the holding back. And Babbitt, like Cage, his music is not about direct expression. He's not trying to tell you about love in Paris in the 80s. He's not trying to express emotion on that level. He's pulling himself back from the expression so that the piece can take on its own form without needing you to think about him in the piece. This is something, as I say, the next generation is really going to reject, and it's going to be something that's going to become almost militantly rejected by the next generation. But I think that's the true intersection between Cage and Babbitt, is they're not trying to put themselves in the piece directly. They're pulling back from the piece so that the piece can be, in a sense, freed. Now let's talk about the point of view of nourishment with Babbitt. Well, what Babbitt did in terms of nourishment was, both in articles and his music, express a whole series of principles that could be used for writing music. The difference between Babbitt and Schoenberg, for example, is that Schoenberg's articles tell you how to write music. Babbitt's articles tell you what happens if you do something. He talks about invariance. He doesn't say you should do it. He says, if you do this, this is what you'll get. If you do this, this is what you'll get. If you do this, this is what you'll get, and I'll demonstrate it in my music for you. So in terms of nourishment, he's trying to provide society with the potentials for going on by giving you the possibilities without a kind of morality that you should do this, but simply that these are the possibilities. So the next generation, as I say, comes into this grand buffet. And they come into the grand buffet also knowing that by the mid-70s, it was absolutely very clear that American music was probably the most dominant force of any music in the world at that stage. The same way that America had become probably the most major world power. I hate to use the analogy, but it's true. And you could see it, first of all, obviously in rock and roll. Rock and roll penetrated everywhere, to the smallest villages of China, ultimately. Things like punk rock, which came out of England, were really an American invention. Jazz, by that stage, had become an extremely important influence in a lot of musics in the world. As I say, the ideas of John Cage penetrated enormously in both Europe and Japan. And then the new romanticism, which I played some of last week, and minimalism, which I played for you, had tremendous influence on the music of the world, all over the place. So you come into this grand buffet with all this wonderful nurturing from your parents, but no moral imperative. And in a sense, one of the last things the avant-garde music could do, or the avant-garde composer could do at that period of history, was question the very necessity of a moral imperative. Do we need it anymore? Do we have to have a one-course meal? Why can't I take a piece from here and a piece from here? Let me read you a little bit by John Adams. John is one of the people associated, I played some of his music last week and you've heard it early on too. He's one of the people associated with the minimal music movement. A very important element in my music is my relationship to popular culture. I think that most great art is a very close relationship to popular culture. In Faust or Don Quixote or Shakespeare or Ulysses, we can find a wonderful intertwining of experience with the artistic gesture. What happened in 20th century art in general, but particularly in classical music, is that it's gone in the wrong-headed direction and become very self-referential. Systems of music grammar become developed that are virtually solipsistic and have no relationship to the lingua franca, musical or emotional. People have written of this referring to Noam Chomsky and linguistics, but it seems quite obvious to me that once an art form becomes self-referential, it's bound to die. I see in serial composers, Babbitt and the European avant-garde, that their music is inaccessible and tends to be music about itself or similar music. I have taken a huge amount of stimulus from popular culture and music, whether it's jazz, rock and roll, or gospel, and I do it in a way that many purists find promiscuous. You know, and it's a quote, it's okay to take these influences and smooth them and shape into the sublime experience, whereas Adams just throws them in the soup pot, unquote. But I think that's what gives my work its vitality and impact. I think that's what drives my critics crazy. They feel it a kind of alarming energy in it that's somehow not quite decent. It's interesting that he almost goes out of his way to criticize Babbitt in this interview, as many critics have over the years. Very often, Babbitt has been referred to in articles when he had absolutely nothing to do with the piece. Very often, if a critic doesn't like a piece and they find it highly academic, quote-unquote, they'll say, like the music of Milton Babbitt, even though maybe Milton never even taught the person, wasn't at the concert, maybe even never met the person. And it became this sort of strange rebellion against this whole idea of a piece being self-referential and not being personally involved in the expression in the piece. Consequences of this have led to a kind of problematic state in contemporary music, and that's what I call the professional composer. And the professional composer really arose in this country in the mid-70s. The idea was sort of foreign up until that time. When I went to college, I graduated in 1969, and I think there were only maybe one or two PhD programs in composition. And they were extremely theoretically based. They weren't really about composition at all. So it was impossible when I graduated to get a PhD in composition. By the mid-70s, there were programs all over the country dealing with PhDs in composition. And for the first time, people would stay in school for much longer, because the longest you could ever stay in school for a master's was generally about 2 years, sometimes three. Now, this leads to a certain kind of problem, because I'm sure you're all thinking at some stage, now and then, probably not right now, what am I going to do when I get out of here to get a job? That's, you know, it's reasonable to think about that. How do you get a job in a university as a composer? Well, it's the same thing as how you get it's similar to how you get a job in a university if you're, let's say, a historian, and it has a lot to do with the sort of public success you've had. If you're a historian, it's based on what you've written, how well respected your articles are, the presentations you've made at meetings. If you're a composer, it's very different. It's not very different than that at all. It's based on how many performances you get and how well respected you are in the musical community. You can not get a job teaching composition somewhere unless you have your pieces played other places. You can not get a promotion in an academic situation unless you get performances. You have to every year submit what performances you've got, and preferably outside of the university, and then if you have enough of them, then maybe you can get a raise in your salary, a raise in your academic position. But what does this mean? What does this mean if you write a music that's not really acceptable by social standards? What would Charles Ives have done if he wanted to get a job in his day? There would have been no way of him getting a job. Another wonderful quote from Morton Feldman, which I think I've read to you, and which you've read, but again, redundancy is the theme today. The real tradition of 20th century America, a tradition evolving from the empiricism of Ives, Verrez, and Cage, has been passed over as iconoclastic, another word for unprofessional. In music, when you do something new, something original, you're an amateur. You're imitators. These are the professionals. It is these imitators who are interested not in what the artist did, but the means he used to do it. This is where craft emerges as an absolute, an authoritarian position that divorces itself from the creative impulse of the originator. The imitator is the greatest enemy of originality. The freedom of the artist is boring to him, because in freedom he cannot reenact the role of the artist. There is, however, another role he can do and does play. It is the imitator, this professional, that makes art into culture. And by the mid-70s, there was a tremendous pressure on the American composer to have the right craft, because if you didn't have the right craft, you wouldn't get the right job. Let's say you decided not to go into the academic world, but to be performed. We talked about packaging and marketing. Let's say I write a piece that becomes very popular and every major symphony plays it. Then let's say I go through an identity crisis and I decide I'm not going to write like this anymore. I'm going to write very, very differently. Okay, let's say a major symphony commissions me for a new piece and I write in this new style of mine and they hate the piece. I'm never going to get another commission from them, am I? But if I write the same piece I wrote the last time with new wrapping on it, they know exactly what they're going to get and they'll buy it from me because they know they're going to get this product from me. So there's become this tremendous pressure on the American composer to conform. And that's a strange thing in America because we're all so different, so what's conformity? There has become a kind of generic classical music of late that has a lot of craft in it, that's not too offensive, that if you write like it, people will perform it, you'll get your performances, you'll be hired, you'll get to teach other PhD students so that they can be hired to teach other PhD students and perpetuate the whole thing. But if you have a kind of image of an art that's different from this whole thing, it's very, very, very difficult for the young composer now. But I'm not going to end on that kind of negative note because I really don't believe it's that disastrous a situation. I think there's an incredible vitality in this country, and I think there's an incredible vitality in this classroom. The kind of idealism you people have, the kind of energy you have, the kind of willingness you have to go places and to base your life on a kind of morally correct stance. And I think you're never going to suppress the young composer from all, not everyone, but many of the young people from doing the kind of music they have to do because it's the only music they feel is right for them to do. And I don't think that's going to change. I think one of the most interesting musics that's happening now is like what I played of John Zorn at the very beginning of the class, which is a music that is based on this grand buffet, but it's not an imitation of the buffet. It's not like saying, well, I'll make a piece of music like this and I'll make it music like this. It's someone who's digested a bunch of the buffet and then it comes out. And then the young American composer in a lot of ways now is a kind of a collage of multiple influences, and a lot of very interesting music is coming out of this kind of composer that's music really is not trying to integrate them into a singularity, but just simply letting all these different things be in their music. I'll play a little bit of a very interesting band I know of in San Francisco. It's called Negative Land. They're a very interesting band. There are three people in it. They mostly just do albums. I think this is about their fourth album. It's called Helter Stupid. Occasionally they perform live in concert, and when they perform live in concert, it's a sort of three nerdish looking computer operators, and there's no instruments on stage, just computers. And all they do is push buttons and run from one computer to the next, and it creates this. This is a long piece. The whole thing is about 30 minutes. I'm just going to play part of it for you, obviously. This is a piece based, I don't know if it's true or not, they claim in this piece that the previous album was called Christianity is Stupid. And they claim that some person committed suicide once they heard that album. I'll just play a little bit of it for you, because I think it really represents what I'm talking about of this kind of grand buffet in music now.
Okay.
Helter Stupid.
Helter Stupid.
Close your eyes.
Helter Stupid.
Listen very carefully.
Christianity is triggering the murder.
Close your eyes.
Christianity is thought-provoking.
Listen very carefully.
Even humorous.
I think we don't accomplish anything by going on like this. This is the same thing you've been saying over and over again.
Well, we're going to listen to those sounds again.
You don't even have that.
This time. I'm going to ask you to do something besides just listening. I would like for you and your friends to pretend you're actually in the places you hear. Make believe that you're doing something.
You don't have enough data.
And while you're pretending and having fun,
you don't have enough data.
Too much data.
Please ask yourself this question.
And what will become of me?
And what will become of me?
You don't have enough data.
Please ask yourself this question.
A photocopy of a diagrammatic analysis of a report.
Please ask yourself this question. Is God here? Is God here in this place doing this kind of thing?
Now listen to this.
L-E-O-N-A. Oh? And I'm with Channel 5 News.
Well, I'm
calling regarding the group, you know,
yeah.
And this article that I'm looking at
here. Okay, sure.
From
hey, what are you guys going to name something like Friday?
That's right.
Are you being stood up?
KPIX Eyewitness News Nightcast is next.
I think you get the idea. There's a lot of the whole thing moves that way. Actually, I think you'd enjoy the other side a lot too. It's all based on radio shows from the 70s. There's like six different songs, each based on different kinds of radio shows and radio logos and that kind of thing. Well, let's go back to the most fundamental question, the one that we started with at the very beginning of the class, and that is, what is the purpose of music? And is there any kind of purpose of music? I think one analogy you can make is that listening to music is sort of like when you decide to go on a vacation. You have two choices when you decide, well, you have more than two choices, but two of the basic choices you have when you go on vacation is you can either go to somewhere where you've been, and you know more or less what you're going to do, but you'll always find new things there. But you know basically where you'll stay and what you'll see and what you'll do. Or you can choose to go somewhere you've never, ever been before, and this is a much more strenuous kind of vacation because you don't have anything to rely on. You have to find things there for yourself. This is the kind of vacation, in a sense, that I think that this course has been for you, and a very brave one, because I don't think when any of you came into this class 26 classes ago, you knew what you were going to be listening to or had any idea of what the subject was, and probably most of you had never heard any of the composers that you've heard. So you've taken that kind of vacation. I think that kind of vacation really makes you understand yourself much better, because you can't rely on your old habits. You can't rely on the things you've done before to say, because I've done it this way, I can do it this way again. Because in a new place where you've never been, you don't know that you can rely on that. And you start learning more about yourself, and you start opening up as a person in a different kind of way. And I think becoming a very strong person, because you know the depths of the things inside you. But where the analogy fades in a certain way, and what I think is a very important point to make, is that I think, oddly enough, down deep, I truly believe you understood the music you heard this term better than you'll ever understand Mozart. Because the composers you heard this term live in the same world you live in. They see the same news shows you see. They see the same newspaper articles. They eat the same kind of food. They dress the same way. They came out of the environment. This is not to say you like it. I never want to force you to like it. I'm just saying that I think down deep, you have much more potential to understand what you hear this term than you do Mozart, because you didn't live 200 years ago in Vienna eating sausage and listening to other Viennese music. So I'm not saying you don't relate to Mozart. I believe you do, and I believe any great piece of art transcends time. But I think what Duchamp said was very true, that there's a certain aura about a piece of art that loses, that evaporates after 30 or 40 years, because it no longer has a true cultural context. It becomes art history, which doesn't mean it's not great art, but it's a different thing and a different experience. I asked the I Ching again with the same lecture about what the purpose of art is, and it said, art provides nourishment. And it went on to say, everything depends upon it being in harmony with what is right. Well, now that's a complicated one, isn't it? That's a very complicated thing. What is right? What is right for a composer to do? And again, I come back to Morty Feldman, and he said, the great work of art is the work of art that cannot be imitated because it's pure personality. All you can do in a work of art is be yourself and what you are. There's this wonderful image in Tibetan Buddhism that human consciousness forms this kind of huge web around the universe, which is basically our gestalt of that period. Now, sometimes this web cracks and human consciousness changes. And the way it cracks is that if someone is sincerely what they are and it doesn't conform with that web, then they break one of the links in the web. Not because they're trying to break the link, simply because as an individual, that's all they can do in the world is be what they are, and that link breaks. And maybe if enough links break in a certain way, they reform in a new way. And we know human consciousness is always reforming in new ways. And a composer, in a sense, is very vital to that kind of linkage, because the composer, a true composer, can only be what the composer is. As I said, that may fall short of the ideals of what he wants to be or she wants to be, but it's all they can be. So consequently, there's this kind of moral imperative that's never left music in America, because America is a very pluralistic place, that the only thing you can do is be what you are. And I'm going to leave you with two last quotes. One was a question that came up last year, which I really loved. It was in the class. I was talking about Dada. No, I was talking about Fluxus, that's right. And it was one of those rather gruesomely negative lectures, you know, where I talked about, well, you remember. Anyway, so one person in the class, about halfway through, raised his hand and he said, then what's the difference between art and life? It's a wonderful Zen koan. A Zen koan is something that they give you in Zen to think about that there's never an answer to. And when you come to the answer, you have a kind of revelation, like what's the sound of one hand clapping or those kinds of things. Well, what is the difference between art and life? How can art not be an expression of life? And the last thing I'd like to leave you with is a comment I heard John Cage make in the 50s. I've never seen it in writing, but it's a wonderful comment. And he said, take it easy, but take it. And again, I want to thank you very much for your kind of openness and optimism that you have. And go on and live well and have a wonderful Christmas, and I'll see you again.